Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate every week. And of course, broadcasting around the world as a podcast too. Perhaps you're among the many people who download it from week to week. You can find more details at our webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And links there, of course, to many of the projects and offshoots and features that are available as well, including this year's Unbelievable DVD, if you're interested in that, and the MP3 and digital download of that. But also, of course, the big conversation video debate series, which a lot of people have been commenting on recently. And in fact, one of the first people to feature in that video series is going to be under discussion today. So let me introduce my guests for today's programme. My guests today are James Croft and Esther O'Reilly.
You're unbelievable.
Because today we're talking about the continuing phenomenon that is Jordan B. Peterson. Back in June, he joined me for a debate that kicked off our big conversation series. Well, that video alone now has over 750,000 views, which gives you an idea of how popular he is online. In fact, he recently drew tens of thousands for a four-part public dialogue with well-known atheist thinker Sam Harris, filling theatres and stadiums in Vancouver, Dublin and London. And the recordings of those encounters have recently been released. So why has this particular Canadian psychologist become so influential, especially among young men? Why is his approach to religion making waves in many atheist circles? What actually went down with Sam Harris? And is the popular atheist movement itself being forced to ask questions about what it exists for and whether it can provide the kind of value and meaning that people seem to hunger for? So to talk through these issues, in which I think will be quite a wide-ranging conversation today, James Croft and Esther O'Reilly join me. Our atheist guest is James Croft, the Outreach Director of the Ethical Society of St. Louis, one of the largest humanist congregations in the world. He recently wrote a blog titled The Atheist Alt-Right Connection, in which he lay out some of his concerns about why parts of the atheist movement seem to be sympathetic to so-called alt-right politics. Well, James has also recently turned his attention to the Jordan Peterson phenomenon. And Peterson, of course, himself has been accused of being an ally, in some sense, of the alt-right. But Esther O'Reilly doesn't think that's the case. She says he's an interesting thinker with some interesting, maybe good ideas. Esther is a Christian blogger on the Pathos Network, whose own blogs on Jordan Peterson's connections with Christianity have been very popular. And she believes that Peterson, while not an Orthodox Christian by any stretch of the imagination, is posing some significant questions to secular humanists like James and popular atheists like Sam Harris. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation today. James, welcome into the studio.
Thank you. It's one of my favourite things to do when I'm visiting
London,
to come to the Premier Studio.
I'm so glad you let me know that you're in the country.
Absolutely.
You're normally based over in the USA,
yes,
aren't you? Just describe very briefly what this humanist congregation is that you're part of.
The Ethical Society of St. Louis is a congregation which offers all the things that a traditional religious congregation offers its members: pastoral care and counseling, talks on Sunday mornings that address the biggest questions of human life. Who am I? Why am I here? How should we treat other people? Educational programs, service and activist opportunities. And most importantly, an opportunity to get to know other people and develop deep relationships with them based on values. But we do all that without reference to God or traditional religion. And that's what makes us a humanist congregation. We've been in St. Louis, Missouri for over 130 years. And I think that our continued success, we have hundreds of members who pledge money to keep the community alive, is a nice demonstration of the possibility of building values-centered communities for people who are not traditionally religious. Mm. And I work there as one of two full-time clergy people who play many of the roles of traditional clergy, yes. just without the religious dogma.
And in that sense, from the outside, it might look a lot like what you might see happening in a Christian church, but obviously without the religious elements and, yeah. and so on. So I'm sure we may well end up talking about that at some level a little later on in the conversation. But let me first of all introduce someone who's new to the programme, Esther O'Reilly. Esther, welcome along to the programme. You're a Christian blogger, and yes. you've kind of really come to fame, in a sense, through some of the blogs you've been writing about Jordan Peterson.
Unexpected, really, yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed reading them, which is why I invited you onto the programme today, because I think, you're an excellent writer. I really just enjoyed the way you wrote them. Tell us yourself about, in particular, there was one article that really sort of got people's attention. It was titled, Sam Harris Asks Questions That Jordan Peterson Can't Answer. Got a lot of shares, including, I think, by Peterson himself.
Indeed.
And it kind of came on the back of these debates that they've had mm-hmm. recently on both sides of the Atlantic. You said in that, actually, that these debates are a must watch for any Christian who wants to understand our culture's spiritual zeitgeist. Why is that exactly?
I think in many ways we're living in what you might call a post-Christian culture, perhaps more so on the continent and in Europe than in America, but here too as well, I think. And I think a lot of Christian pastors have been trying to figure out how a guy like Peterson can fill stadiums and lecture halls for thousands and thousands of people to come here and speak about the Bible when these pastors are preaching every Sunday to half-empty pews. But it won't do to just sort of sit around and stew about it. You know, you've got to go out there and engage with the ideas that are being presented, and you've got to try to understand what young people in particular are finding so compelling. And I think Sam Harris is a really interesting foil in this respect, because he represents what might be called the sort of old guard of atheism, you know, the four horsemen. And he's feeling a bit uneasy on his throne, perhaps, because a lot of his audience is being drawn away to Peterson. So I think studying why that's going on is very interesting for the Christian, because it can sort of point up how to speak to this audience and what they're looking for, and what might be missing in both Peterson and Harris's approaches that a Christian could come along and fill.
These are both Peterson and Harris, as much as they have differing ways of approaching the questions that they've been debating, they're both what has come to be called the so-called intellectual dark web, which sounds very threatening and malign, but
terrible name, by the way. I hate that name.
Could for those who aren't yet aware of this movement, though, can you kind of try and encapsulate what it is and who's part of it?
I could try. It's really, I'm not even entirely sure that it's a natural kind. It's a sort of loose, very loose conglomerate of political writers and scientists and a couple podcast hosts who really don't share that much in common, except very vaguely that each of them has at some point done or said something or other that's been perceived by some people as politically incorrect. And so some people would include Peterson, of course, and Ben Shapiro, conservative political writer. Eric and Brett Weinstein, two scientists, have been brought in recently, and Sam Harris. And so, like I said, really, there are a lot of deep disagreements within them, but they all sort of come together roughly under the banner of having a free exchange of ideas and looking at research that's maybe not getting as much attention in mainstream culture, and perhaps questioning some assumptions of that. And I think people find those conversations refreshing, because there are a lot of, you know, reasonable, intelligent people who feel as if they're being judged as lacking in empathy or as cold or noxious if they don't happen to agree with the left-wing narrative of everything. And so they find it refreshing to hear a different view being expressed, although I think not with the odiousness that's accompanied figures like the now disgraced Milo Yiannopoulos, for example. I think this is a very different sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, though, they're not afraid necessarily of being a bit politically incorrect. That's something that I see somehow slightly joins them together. There's a sense in which they're sort of
slightly, but I really think overall it's a much more thoughtful and humane level of dialogue. Yeah. I mean, I saw Milo as a quite odious provocateur character who would insult people and you know, encourage people to be, you know, really vile and vicious, and of course his recent comments about pedophilia sort of toppled him there. And so I see lots of people who are fans of Peterson who really, really do not like characters like Milo.
And what kind of space are these, whether it's Sam Harris on the one side as, you know, quite a out there atheist, and Peterson with his particular sort of psychological take on religion and meaning and so on. What kind of a void are they speaking into? Why, are they drawing these massive crowds of predominantly young men, as far as I can see, to hear them just have a 2-hour conversation, which on the face of it, you wouldn't think you'd be able to fill the O2 in London for, but apparently you can.
Yeah, well, it was quite remarkable because every one of the conversations, they paused partway through to ask the audience if they wanted to go to a Q&A or if they just wanted the dialogue to continue. And every time, resoundingly, the vote was continue, continue, we'll give up our Q&A. So that's really quite something. I would say that I think Sam, I mean, no offense to Sam, but I think at this point he's sort of riding along on Peterson's coattails. I don't think Sam could have drawn these sorts of crowds purely on his own. But I would say that that Peterson is sort of rekindling a respect for the Bible, for Scripture, which kind of irks Sam because he wishes we could just sort of be done with it and toss it into the dustbin of Iron Age history, you know. But Peterson, I think in particular, speaks to the void by talking about, you know, acting properly and aiming towards a noble goal, and trying to set yourself in order so that you can prepare for suffering, so that you can mend broken relationships. And, you know, this has even saved some lives, you know, young men who thought about ending it all. And Peterson would say, no, actually, your life has value. And you don't have the right to just cut that off, because everything that you do matters, which is both a terrible burden and a glorious challenge. And young men have not been hearing that kind of talk for a very, very long time, young men in particular, although I see quite a few young women who benefit from it as well. And I think that's really caught fire and caught people's attention.
I mean, I see him as very much sort of having become almost this paternal father figure to a lot of young men who evidently feel somehow a bit lost at sea. They're not sure of their identity. You know, and you know, to put it crudely, you know, I think there are a lot of young men seem to have this testimony almost of when they write about, you know, in glowing terms, Peterson, you know, well, I was just at home wasting my life masturbating to porn and playing video games. Now I have a sort of purpose to live for and so on. So it's he seems to be getting at some sort of, you know, he's scratching an itch that's obviously there.
Yeah, and he's scratching an itch that I think people like Harris are not really able to scratch. They just haven't found that gear, and Peterson now has.
Yeah. James, we will come to your specific article, which I think links in to some extent to this about the atheist and alt-right movement. But it was really when I asked you to come on with Esther that you kind of were forced to go and look up Jordan Peterson in a bit more detail.
Yes.
What have you made?
Thanks so much for that.
I can tell already you're probably not the biggest fan, and maybe we'll come to that.
Well, but, I'm not the biggest fan.
What's your feeling?
Hours and hours watching these extraordinary debates, and I feel the force of Esther's question, certainly. I'm someone who speaks regularly to a community, and I would love to be able to bring in thousands of people to hear what I have to say, and I certainly couldn't fill the O2 yet, although I'm writing a book and we'll see what happens. But
just remember me when it comes out, James.
Yes, right? You bet. I'll remember you, all the little people who I pass by, my meteoric rise to fame. But I think it is a good question. What's happening in the culture that these figures, Peterson particularly, but also the people he's been debating with, Sam Harris and Douglas Murray, What are they saying that gets so many people willing to pay for a ticket to listen to them for 2.5 hours?
Mm.
That's a reasonable question to ask. And I think that there are, in my mind, two answers, both of which are a major part of the story. And Esther's been talking about one of them.
Mm.
I'm perfectly willing to believe that some people find in what someone like Peterson is saying an affirming message, an intellectually interesting message that helps them respond to real problems in their life. If that's what people are finding in it and it genuinely helps them with challenges that they're facing, then I think as far as it goes, that's a good thing. I don't want people to be deprived of things that help them deal with their feelings of inadequacy or loneliness or anything like that. I have to say, I think the book that he wrote is not a particularly insightful or philosophically interesting book, but often self-help books are not particularly philosophically interesting or insightful. They just give simple, time-worn advice in a reasonably compelling narrative package, and maybe that's what he's doing for some people. But I do think that there's a whole second piece of this picture that we shouldn't not talk about, and that is maybe even more a reason why so many people, particularly, as you've both said, young men, are turning towards figures like this. And it's exactly the point that Esther made when she was mentioning about the things that bring together this loose connection of people in the so-called intellectual dark web. And that is their perceived willingness to challenge what they present as a leftist cultural hegemony, which is shutting out discourse on important social topics. So if you look at Peterson in particular, he was not famous in the way that he's famous today when he was just writing about religion and psychology and neuroscience and things like that. He wrote his first book all about those topics in much greater depth than his most recent book, and he was not the phenomenon that he is today. What catapulted him to fame and to much broader public acknowledgement of his work, as he says himself, and every article about his career corroborates that I have read, was his opposition publicly to a Canadian law that was being discussed in Parliament, the hope of which was to protect transgender people from discrimination by federal bodies and to include them in hate crimes laws, so that this very small, highly targeted minority who lives much of their lives at risk of physical violence and discrimination would be protected by the laws of the state. And Peterson was against that. He didn't want that law to be passed. And he made a series of arguments in a series of YouTube videos that he both filmed and then publicized. So he wanted people to know that he was against this. That were based on wild misrepresentations of the law, as all the legal bodies at the time said, and which presented it essentially as an assault on his freedom of speech and his ability to choose his own words, even though there's no evidence that the law will ever be used in that way or could be used in that way. And that's what made him famous. And so I think that if you look at the source of his fame, there's this much darker story about people like Jordan Peterson and the other members of the intellectual dark web, which is that they are standing up and, in their minds, bravely saying that it should be okay to discriminate against these minority groups. And in the case of Sam Harris,
well,
perhaps...
My only fear in going down this road is that we could debate that the whole transgender thing that brought Peterson to fame originally. I feel like I should allow Esther probably to give her take on that particular issue that brought Peterson. But then perhaps we may have to draw a line under it and move on. Otherwise, I fear we could sort of debate that one issue.
Do you mind if I just link in the other members of the intellectual dark web a tiny bit?
Yeah.
Because it's not just Peterson.
Right.
It's also Sam Harris with some of his statements about Islam that have gone beyond what I think is reasonable discourse about certain beliefs and practices of some Muslims towards a form of kind of racism. And then it's also these other members of the so-called intellectual dark web, Douglas Murray certainly, who flirt with discredited pseudoscientific views, who are quite willing to engage in dog whistle politics that signal to people on the far right that they share some of their fundamental concerns, even if they don't necessarily agree with what's to be done about them. And I think that that is a significant part of the story of their success. And I think we know that because, firstly, it's what made Peterson famous, and secondly, because it's what draws all these intellectuals together, that they present themselves as taking a stand against what they call political correctness and I would call simple human decency.
Okay, Esther, again, we don't have time to fully delve into this, but what's your take on the way James has presented what brought Peterson to fame originally?
Well, specifically as far as the transgender thing goes, James and I are not going to find a whole lot of common ground there. I would say Peterson himself has said that he wouldn't refuse on principle to use he for she or she for he, for example. So that's a distinction he himself has made. As far as the law itself, I mean, that would be a discussion unto itself. But suffice it to say that I think James is underplaying Peterson's concerns there. I would say that with regard to the phenomenon as a whole and bringing in Sam Harris and Douglas Murray and the discussions of immigration, for example, the phrase simple human decency there at the end, it made me think of Thomas Sowell when he talks about the vision of the anointed, which, you know, again, it's a sort of setting up, we are the ones who care, we are the virtuous ones, we have the anointed vision, you are the benighted ones if you so much as dare to disagree with any of this narrative. And I think a guy like Murray in his research on the immigration problem has pointed out again and again that like many things, this is an enormously complex social issue. And it's the sort of thing about which reasonable people could disagree because it's just a multivariate problem. And there are no, you know, facile solutions to it. And so I think again, this is why a lot of people are frustrated with the kind of turn that the culture is taking, because they would say, well, no, I do care. Peterson also, I would say, speaks about dispossessed classes, that the hierarchies leave people dispossessed, and we should speak about that. And we should talk about whether the left might have a natural voice in that. And you know, not simply run roughshod over people. And so I think there's the media has crafted a certain narrative about Peterson and about other people that's, I would say, unfairly skewed.
I mean, perhaps let's leave the politics to one side. What's interesting is, regardless of how he came to prominence.
Well, Peterson, I would say there's been two bumps. I mean, the Bill C-16 was one, but there was also the Kathy Newman interview, and that was the first I heard of him. I didn't.
That's interesting.
I hadn't heard of him until the Newman thing, which was a sort of a different flavor of phenomenon.
Little known fact, just before you come back, James, when I recorded my debate between Jordan Peterson and Susan Blackmore for The Big Conversation, we actually recorded that quite early in the year, and it was just a couple of days later that he went and did that interview with Kathy Newman, which suddenly propelled him into the public spotlight, which, for those who haven't watched it, is essentially them having a good old debate on the gender pay gap, and a lot of people believe that Jordan sort of rather skewered Kathy Newman's sort of quite dogmatic interviewing style with his sort of calmly rational approach to it. Now, whether that is the way you see it or not, what were you going to say, James?
Well, I was just going to say I actually see that interview as part as of a piece with that second strand to their popularity that I was describing. If you look at how his fans portray that, it's exactly as you just said, Justin. It's male intellectual defeats female interviewer. And if you look at the top videos that come up when you search Jordan Peterson on YouTube, I did it just before we went on air, you'll see that it's this ream of Jordan Peterson defeats this person who happens to be a woman, or this student who happens to be a woman, and this reporter who happens to be a woman. And it's an extraordinary thread that it is male YouTubers upholding a male figure who is, in their eyes, defeating women's voices who are arguing for women's equality. And if you look at his intellectual project, you know, I read his most recent book in order to have this discussion. It's very explicit. He talks that his organizing principle is the opposition between order and chaos, order which he describes explicitly as masculine, and chaos, which he describes explicitly as feminine, and he talks throughout as needing to rebalance by injecting, as it were, more of the masculine in. And I think young men who feel challenged by the cultural climate in which women are asserting their dignity and saying it's not okay to touch us without permission, it's not okay for a woman to be raped and then for a man to be elected to the Supreme Court, for instance, that is challenging to many men. They have to look at their own behavior. We have to look at our own behavior. We have to examine our place in society, examine the privileges we've been given just by being men. And that's very difficult. And it feels like people are being denigrated and being told to be quiet. And I understand that many men feel that way. And here comes Jordan Peterson, whose whole theory is based around the importance of the masculine. And they uphold him as a sort of masculine idol who is defeating these feminist women. I think that's exactly what I'm describing. It is this dark occurrence.
As the woman here, I feel bound to play my woman card for a moment here.
You play that trump card. Go ahead.
Yeah, good. I hardly ever get to do this. So much fun. I would say it's a very distorted picture. I mean, first, very quickly, the order of chaos thing, these are archetypal categories. And Peterson has plenty to say about the pathologies of the order side of that, as well as the chaos. And his point is that there must be a balance between the two, not that order must dominate chaos. And so I don't think you can extract from that he's a misogynistic woman hater. I would also say he himself has expressed disappointment in the whole clickbait culture of YouTube and has said that he wishes that people wouldn't create these cutouts of Jordan owns so-and-so, defeats so-and-so. He would rather have more of a dialogue and bring out reasonable discourse and have ideas be hashed out in that way. But, you know, he can't really control that. And I would say a lot of what I see in his male audience is actually a sober reexamination of their attitudes towards women. And in fact, I see men saying, you know, I think that maybe I should save sex for commitment. I think perhaps I've been blaming women for my problems. I've been using women. And instead, maybe I should have a look in the mirror and make myself the sort of man that a woman would actually want to date. And that's really the heart of Peterson's message. But you wouldn't really know that from hearing people like James, talk about him. And so I think that's what I would say as a woman. And the whole enforced monogamy thing, I mean, we don't have to go down that route.
We'll park these issues because we're just coming up to our first break. And after the break, I want to get into more the kind of meaning, value, religion, kind of those were the big issues that were being debated over these four nights with Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris. And how James puts that together, what you think is going on there, Esther. And we'll continue this fascinating conversation. It's always fun to talk about other people, isn't it? And that's what we're kind of doing today. We're having a conversation about another conversation. That's all part of what we do here on Unbelievable. We'll try and bring you the beating pulse of what's going on in the culture at the moment. And we're doing it with my guests today, James Croft and Esther O'Reilly. Do tune in for the second part of today's show in just a moment.
Premier Christianity Magazine. In this month's issue...
Is climate change our biggest threat? Increasing numbers of Christians are saying yes. Find out why in the latest edition of Premier Christianity Magazine. Plus, we talk to Rachel Gardner, the youth worker, on a mission to instill courage into the next generation of women. And as Google celebrates its 20th birthday, we ask, what happened to its motto, "Don't be evil"? All this, plus features on everything from the death penalty to single parenting.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample. You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. A real smorgasbord of different issues that we're dealing with on today's programme. No very defined question at stake, but we're talking about Jordan Peterson, the phenomenon that is Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, well-known within the atheist movement, the intellectual dark web, the alt-right, and other things included. This is an edition of Unbelievable where I'm joined by James Croft and Esther O'Reilly. James Croft is the outreach director of the Ethical Society of St. Louis, one of the largest humanist congregations in the world. Esther O'Reilly is a Christian blogger on the Pathos Network who's been writing on Jordan Peterson and Sam Harris and various other interesting things as well. Links, of course, to both of my guests from today's show show at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And there you can find links to get in touch with the show as well. If you'd like to leave your thoughts about these interesting characters and these recent debates that have gone on between Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson, then do feel free to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can leave your thoughts via our Facebook and a Twitter account as well, of course, at UnbelievableJB, or on the Facebook, it's facebook.com/UnbelievableJB, and we'll hear some of your thoughts about recent shows towards the end of today's programme. So coming back to you, James, what made me get in touch with you initially, or what we sort of thought we might end up talking about, though that kind of changed over the course of a week or two, was this article you'd written on your blog, which was called The Atheist Alt-Right Connection. And you kind of laid out a number of things that you think are potentially problematic in the sort of popular atheist movement, if you like. An identity built on opposition, a sense of superiority, breaking the biggest taboos, the white maleness of the movement. And you even referenced the atheist movement's transphobia, ableism, resistance to identity politics. Now, some of this ties in with what you've already been saying about your fears around Peterson, Harris and others. What's been interesting to see is that the atheist movement, quote unquote, has itself kind of come to a point where suddenly people have thought, well, what do we exist for? Are we about this or about this? Are we about the kind of the right to say exactly whatever you want, whenever you want, because we're free thinkers and, you know, to hell with the rest of you? Or are we actually about a movement that's trying to shape something that's about human flourishing and decency and everything else? And I have a feeling you like to think of yourself more on the latter rather than the former end.
I think that's true.
And so who, I mean, if you're willing to name a few names, who do you kind of see as on those different sort of ends of the spectrum? And who were you writing this article for when you wrote it?
Well, I wrote that article in response to a dialogue that was started by Chris Stedman, who's another atheist activist and who works in humanist circles, who I know well. He kind of opened up the discussion of, do we have a problem within the atheist movement, by which we mean the organizations and the conferences and the books, not atheism as a philosophy or atheists as people necessarily, but within the organized movement, of touch points, points of similarity where people might cross over from being engaged in our movement to something much more dangerous and problematic, like the alt-right. And I think that he was correct in raising an alarm about that. I, in fact, think that every movement should be worried about that, because my suspicion is that there are people who are moving towards the extreme right who come from every religious movement, and everyone should look at how they talk about their values and how they organize their conferences and things like that to prevent people moving in that direction. But I feel a responsibility for the atheist movement as someone who is a member of it and a voice that people sometimes occasionally read and even less occasionally listen to. But I do recognize the tension you describe as something that I've been working on throughout my time in the movement, in trying to encourage people to think of it more of something more than just a place where people can say whatever they want, because free speech is the highest value, but a place where we're trying to construct a worldview which places the flourishing of people at the center and tries to promote that in every way that we can. And I do think when I look at figures like Sam Harris, he has fallen under a misapprehension, a philosophical misapprehension, that freedom of speech and freedom of thought should in all cases take primacy over every other concern. And in fact, that came out in one of the debates with Jordan Peterson where that was explicitly stated as a value. And I think that that's just a wrong philosophical value. And I think it leads to things like him having on his program, for the purposes of debate, discredited IQ scientists who asked the question, is it possible that black people are just biologically stupider than white people? Which is flatly what they were discussing. And I think that entertaining those racist ideas at a time when neo-Nazis are literally marching the streets of major European cities, giving Hitler salutes, you know, chasing in Germany people they think to be migrants around the streets and throwing bottles at them. I was walking down the Thames just a couple of weeks ago and saw swastikas spray painted along the towpath. In that climate, do you really want to mobilize your viewers to consider the possibility that there is a biological inferiority of black people? I find that extraordinarily wrong to do. I think it's morally negligent, even if you think there's something to the science and there's no reason to think that.
Do you equally see when, I don't know, someone, an atheist, says, yes, of course we should put out cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad because it's about our free speech. Do you say, yes, that is your right, but you've got to temper it with what is the actual effect of this
Absolutely.
Going to be?
And I had that discussion myself with atheist and secular organizations when I was a student activist and Everybody Draw Muhammad Day was a thing that people were doing. I tried to encourage people to think about the effects of doing that on the Muslim students on their campus, because I agree they have the right to do it, the legal right, and it's important that they have the legal right to do that. But the effects of doing it may be to make a already marginalized minority community feel more threatened on campus. And I don't think that's right. I don't think...
And this is where your kind of concern over this idea that atheism is about having the right to break the biggest taboos, as you say in this
yes.
article and so on.
And you see that in the alt-right. You see that directly right. as a component of the appeal of the alt-right, is that they are peddling a narrative. I mean, ironically, perhaps not ironically, it is a sort of mythic narrative, like the ones that Jordan Peterson talks about in his writing, of one in which there is an embattled group, which are, you know, cis white men, basically, cis straight white men, who are being shut down and threatened by a opposing force, this supposed cultural hegemony that Peterson has described as similar to cultural Marxism, which is ludicrous claim on its face, but that's the sort of story that he tells. And they need champions who are brave enough to take the fight and say the real truths, the things that no one's willing to talk about. And the things that they claim that no one's willing to talk about, Sam Harris and Peterson and people like them, are things like, you know, the genetic inferiority of people of color, and maybe trans people shouldn't be protected by law against discrimination. But those are not brave truths. Those are ancient prejudices. And they are being packaged as brave truths in order, I think, to reinforce prejudices people already have.
Esther, time to bring you in at this point. What do you make, again, of James's characterization of the sort of thing that Sam Harris, as he sees it, or that version of atheism, is bringing into, you know, the way it allies to his view with sympathizers of the alt-right and so on?
I have seen some overlap to that extent, and the whole white supremacist wing tends to be pretty stridently atheist. But I do think that it's rather pernicious to try somehow to link people like Peterson with all that. I would encourage everyone to go on YouTube and just look up Jordan Peterson answers a question about white pride or something. That should be the key phrase, where he comes down like a hammer on that whole idea of, you know, of whiteness being a virtue in itself, and that we should, you know, feel proud of what our culture and our race has built. And Jordan essentially gives the equivalent of a "you didn't build that" answer. It's quite bracing. And I would also agree, I have very strong concerns about the alt-right, and with the rise of Trump, I was distressed to see many people downplaying their effect, like, oh, well, I mean, it's just a few scattered people in their parents' basement, da da da. But they can mobilize quite effectively, particularly on the internet, and they will attack, as James has pointed out, they will attack people of color and, you know, actresses that they don't like and whatnot. And so I do think we need to be speaking about that more. And I think Peterson should maybe explicitly disavow that more. I don't think that he really understands the force of this particular element. He sees perhaps that it's a small sub pocket of his fan base, and so he feels like he doesn't have to say that much about it. But I think he should. And I would say actually that Sam Harris has pressed Peterson to disavow more explicitly. So I think this is also not fair to Harris, and I'm no great fan of Harris, but he's spoken quite a bit and expressed his own concerns with the alt-right. And he will even tell Douglas Murray, you know, you really shouldn't just go have a conversation with Stefan Molyneux or anybody, these people who are sort of obsessed with the IQ question, because this isn't the sort of thing that anyone should be obsessed with or should be talking about excitedly. You know, it's, you know, if there's data to discuss or to put out there, that's one thing. But the minute you begin fetishizing it is the moment you begin going down a very, very dark path indeed. So while I would agree with some of Jane's concerns, and while I think I would say that I see at the fan bases sometimes some overlap with Harris in particular, though not so much with Peterson, I don't think that it's fair to these figures to try to make such explicit connections. I think that does a disservice to them and to their ideas and to what they've actually said.
Let's start talking about the actual religious issues, though, that were the substance of these debates that we've been talking about between Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson. What was your takeaway, Esther, yourself, in terms of did we get any closer to knowing whether Jordan Peterson believes in God, firstly, and did we?
I should think that would be obvious that he doesn't. I mean, you know, frankly, I find it sort of amusing that there's been like all this discussion, like, oh, does he, doesn't he, is he, isn't he? And I just want to come along and say, well, I mean, it's quite clear that he doesn't. I do think he's open. I do think he's, you know, clearly delineates himself from someone like Sam, and that Sam is, you know, pretty closed to more evidence on this point. He's very comfortable and entrenched in his atheism. Peterson, I would say, is more of an open agnostic. And I think this is partly tied to his rather quirky epistemology, a sort of radical agnosticism. He's not even particularly sure we can know much of anything. So I would say he definitely leaves the door open for the resurrection. I even myself had a brief exchange with him about that, where he said, quite honestly, you know, I don't know what to make of the resurrection. I don't understand it very well. And so I try to bracket the metaphysical questions and focus on the psychological realm. But that doesn't mean that I think the biblical stories are exhausted in the psychological realm. I'm not prepared to assert that as fact. I need more time.
This did feature an interesting little interchange between Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson, I think, in the first dialogue they had, where basically Sam Harris challenged Peterson and said, look, do you think the resurrection happened?
And yes.
Do you just want to describe what happened in that moment? Because you wrote about it on this blog of yours as well.
Yeah, fascinating exchange. Sam said, look, please, can we for a moment put aside the metaphorical and just put this in cold, hard, probabilistic terms? Can I at least get you to affirm that Jesus probably didn't rise from the dead? You know, like, how's this for an answer? Probably not. And, you know, people are cheering him. And Peterson goes, well, you know, that's fine. That's what people have been saying. But the idea of resurrection doesn't seem to go away. And Sam's like, well, but what's that's evidence of what exactly? And Peterson said, I don't know. Now, I'm inclined to agree with Sam that merely observing sort of archetypal resurrection ideas or narratives is quite weak when it comes to evaluating a concrete historical claim like the resurrection of Christ. But I do think that highlighted Peterson's sort of hesitance and ambivalence. And I happen to know that he's got N.T. Wright on the shelf and is quite eager to delve into that and to make the resurrection his next project, because I think he understands that there's something quite significant here and that it won't do to just sort of wave it away as not worth further investigation, as I believe Harris does, and all of the new atheists that sort of typifies them.
It is so intriguing. I mean, this is kind of where I wrote a little article after I had this discussion show with Peterson, asking that similar kinds of questions, you know, well, where does he stand on the God question, the Jesus question? And I kind of came down in a similar place. I think he's sort of basically agnostic on it, but he's sort of interested in pursuing it. And he's even talked about, you know, well, if you gave me 40 hours to kind of investigate the metaphysical claim, I might be able to come
back.
But
bless him, he needs 40 hours to talk about anything.
I mean, in that sense, you know, maybe that's a question he will get to. In the meantime, he talks all the time about the psychological kind of truth of religion, and that's
and
kind of
understand some of it too. Yeah. I think in some key
ways. And what was kind of your takeaway on what the main difference was between him and Harris when it came to the way they view religion in terms of its utility and its truth in that sort of psychological sense?
Well, I think this could be encapsulated in G.K. Chesterton's parable of the fence. You walk up and you see a fence built across somewhere, and the reformer says, well, I have no idea what this is doing here, so I think I shall tear it down. And Chesterton says, the very fact that you don't know why it's here is the very reason why you shouldn't tear it down, at least not without going home and giving it some very, very serious thought. And I think that's Peterson's point. You know, in computer programming terms, if I can get a little nerdy here, Peterson is saying, don't mess with the registry. You know, don't muck around with the foundational DNA of civilization, because you don't know what seven demons might rush into that vacuum. And I think I sympathize with Peterson's point. I do think that there's a place for custom. I think there's a place for, you know, that the man who goes to Mass every Sunday, even if he's not quite sure he believes all this. But I think that Sam's point is that won't last forever. At a certain point, you need to have good reasons for what you believe. And the truth claims, the concrete truth claims matter. So that man who goes to Mass, you know, when his sons ask him, why do we do this? What does this all mean? How can I know that it's true? He must have an answer. He must have an answer. And in that respect, though Sam and I are, of course, on completely opposite sides of the divide, I think we have a point of contact here. And I think it's good that he pressed Peterson on that and that he brought that to the surface. But I do also think that Peterson made points that Sam is missing. I think Peterson's right that Sam doesn't address the void, for example, and also that Sam doesn't have a sufficiently deep appreciation of good and evil, let's say.
We're opening up a huge area here, but one of the key things I came away from is that constantly the repeated theme was Sam's view is we can get the good society, the good life, the flourishing mm-hmm. by going from the facts we can see and then deciding, you know, and those will give us the values we need. And Peterson's constant refrain was, you can't do it that way around. You have to have what he calls this sort of
metaphoric
substrate, whatever it is, this way of interpreting the facts that has to come first. And that is what religion has done for us for millennia. And it's kind of it's buried deep inside our evolutionary history and everything else. And Sam, you're to think you can just replace it with a kind of pure reason is a mm-hmm. major fallacy. And a lot of the debate was simply about how much religion can you retain or you know, eject in the process. And as you say, Jordan Peterson, much more conservative, saying it may be doing something that you simply can't imagine, Sam, at this point. And you simply chucking it out, you're going to throw out an awful lot of baby with the bathwater and so on. James, I'd be interested just in your overall response. I mean, you kind of grimaced a bit when mentioning you had to sit through 4 hours of...
Oh, I just have a very mobile face, Justin.
what do you make of these
particular...
Right,
I mean,
okay.
I don't think that I want to kind of defend Sam Harris's view, which I don't entirely agree with, or Jordan Peterson's view, which I don't entirely agree with. I think I have a different way of looking at these problems that makes some of the conversation seem a bit weird to me. I think I will say that I do think it's important to distinguish simply between the question, did this thing actually happen at some point in the past, which I think is a...
Are we talking about the resurrection here?
Anything. Right, okay. We can talk about the resurrection, okay. We can talk about any historical event, asking whether it happened.
Right.
And the question, does the story of this thing have... potential to give us psychological goodies that would be difficult to get otherwise. Mm. And in my mind, those are easily distinguishable questions. Mm. Neither of them are likely easy to be answered, but the fact that they are different questions is quite clear to me in my mind. Mm. And I don't know why Peterson seems to have quite so much difficulty in separating them and saying, well, I don't have a lot of evidence to believe that the resurrection actually happened, but I really am interested in the fact that resurrection stories persist across centuries and millennia in many different cultures across the world, and I'm really interested in examining why that might be and what use they might hold for us in human life. A lot of psychologists of religion are perfectly capable of making that distinction and do interesting work on that basis, and it's interesting to me that Peterson is so unclear in that area.
Are you more sympathetic then to Harris's kind of take on this whole thing then, which is, yes, they may have psychological value, but frankly, we've kind of outgrown these stories. We can do it a lot better with our own reason and the science and technology that we have available to us now.
Well, I'm someone who used to be an actor. I used to do a lot of acting, and one of my main intellectual areas of interest is the philosophy of art, aesthetics. And so I'm very interested in narratives. I'm a preacher by part of my profession. I speak on Sundays to people in the mode of stories, which hopefully ennoble them and call them to a higher moral path. And I'm very conscious when I'm doing that I'm using essentially parables and elements drawn from my own life, shaped into a story shape, because I know that motivates people. And so I'm totally open to the power of stories, including fictional stories, to change how we live. And I think that that's a good thing. We should recognize, and to the extent that some atheist voices are resistant to the use of narrative and metaphor, which is something I've encountered in my work, a certain resistance, then I think that they're just wrong. They're not going to get the changes in people's behavior we might like to see simply by attempting to give people propositions and steps in an argument that show them that that behavior is better. To actually move people, you have to emotionally engage them, and that often you do through narrative. But I think the thing that's wrong with the way that Peterson looks at it is I don't get this idea that you might be tampering with forces better left untouched, in the context where it's pretty clear that by following certain religious narratives, many people are concretely harmed and set aside from society into lesser roles, right? We can see throughout history that interpretations of religious narratives have very often, though of course not always, led to the disempowerment and oppression of peoples. And wherever that is still happening, I think we can just say we need to not do that, particularly on the basis of stories we have no good reason to believe are true. And that even if that results in some sort of grand psychic harm to the structure of society, we can deal with that when it happens and as it happens, but let's stop doing the harm we're doing right now, at the very least. So I guess I don't see this as a bigger problem as they seem to think it is.
Esther, what's your take on what James has said?
Yeah, I definitely disagree. First of all, I would say that not all religions are equal. And so certainly, I'm sure that Peterson would not say any religion will do. With Islam, I think in particular, you can see the oppression of women and terrorism and all that. He would say, definitely, let's not go there. But I think Douglas Murray put it well in an article called, I believe it was called, Would Human Life Be Sacred in an Atheist World? He said, religion holds men back, though not always stopping them. And he makes a point, he quotes David Berlinski. He's saying, you know, what did the Nazi Guard and the SS, the NKVD, and all of these people, the people who put Jews on trains, what did they have in common? We thought God wasn't watching them. Now, Sam, of course, comes back and says, well, it's no better if you think God is watching and clapping along. But I think that the point that Douglas wants to make is that there seems to be this bent in human nature to turn to our worst instincts. And then I think from Peterson's point of view, this is sort of connected to his whole grand Jungifying theory. He thinks that the way we got our morals was by telling stories to each other. And so I don't agree with his whole idea of the evolution of how that came to be, but I think that's where that's coming from, that he says you're sort of messing with the very process by which we create our morality. But, you know, as far as whether Christianity, say, for example, like Orthodox Christianity, is an oppressive system, I think James and I would simply disagree on that point. I think that true Christianity is to love all people and to value all people as made with dignity and made in the image of God. But that's not necessarily equivalent to a complete permissiveness or to saying that people can do what they like as long as can have sex with whomever they want as long as it's consensual, say, or these sorts of things that I know James is quite passionate about.
I'll let James respond to that in a minute. But I mean, just because his name's come up a few times, and we haven't really explained who he is for anyone who isn't aware. Douglas Murray is someone you're quite a fan of, I know, yourself, Esther.
That damned elusive people now, yes.
And he was the moderator of the second two of these Harris and Peterson debates. Interesting, Douglas Murray himself is an atheist. They're a part of this so-called intellectual dark web. Someone who obviously, James, from everything you've said, disagrees strongly with on some aspects, and who seems to saying things that are very sympathetic to your point of view, Esther, at one level, writing this article, you know, Will Human Life Be Sacred in an Atheist World? Suggesting that simply atheism per se or kind of a denial of the religious doesn't necessarily lead us to some utopia, because he's worried, I think, that the vacuum could enable all kinds of nihilistic or fundamentalist other worldviews to occupy that space. So you explain why you think that's, this is the kind of atheist you're happy to kind of talk about and promote the views of, as opposed to a Sam Harris, say.
I think Douglas is has a much, I think, a much deeper perspective on these things than Sam. You know, Sam grew up in a, you know, West Coast Hollywood, you know, secular home. He spent some time wandering around in the East doing drugs and meditating. You know, I don't think Sam really understands the depth of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Douglas, by contrast, was a quite devout Christian until his late 20s, when he finally sort of made a painful break with faith because he just felt like he couldn't believe. He just felt like the evidence wasn't there. So I think there's a strong sort of Christ-haunted quality in his work, to quote Flannery O'Connor, sort of wistfulness there for what's been lost. And I think it's interesting how he keeps coming back to, for instance, the progress of euthanasia and end-of-life issues. That's something he mentions in the article, something he comes back to quite a bit. Because, you know, it really disturbs him, I think, and it disturbs him to see that it seems so often that it's Christians who are speaking up on these issues and not atheists so much. And, you know, he says at the end of that article, basically, you've got three choices. You can just sort of topple over the cliff into nihilism, or you can really try to hash out a secular framework for sanctity of life, which is what people like, you know, Richard Norman are occupied with trying to do, or sort of go back to faith, whether we like it or not. Because I think he recognizes that the sanctity of life is sort of grounded in Judeo-Christian roots and Judeo-Christian heritage. And I'd like to sort of, I want to give James a chance to speak here, but I found something quite interesting in Richard Norman's book on humanism that I wanted to touch on in this respect. So I don't know if you want to come back to that in a second.
Well, let's come back to it, because we're already at the end of our second part and we've just got another 10 or 15 minutes to kind of wrap up and continue today's conversation. So we'll come to see what James has to say in response to that. And because I think we should touch on the humanism that James inhabits and where that touches or differs from the kind of worldview that Harris and Douglas Murray and others are talking about here. But we're just having a really interesting roundtable conversation, really, on Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, the atheist movement, the intellectual dark web, the alt-right. It's all coming out today on Unbelievable, and I hope you're enjoying the conversation as much as I am with James Croft and Esther O'Reilly, my guests on today's edition of the programme. We'll be back in just a moment.
I'm Justin Brierley. Join me for the brand new video series, The Big Conversation, where I'll be joined by some of the leading thinkers from the Christian and atheist communities. Guests include Reverend Richard Coles.
That experience of an encounter with the reality of the resurrected Christ was life-changing.
Susan Blackmore.
My response is, nothing matters. It's all empty and meaningless. Get used to it.
Jordan Peterson.
I do believe that the biblical texts are foundation.
Darren Brown.
Something that makes us connect with that thing that is outside of ourselves. I can't put a name on that.
Visit thebigconversation.show.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable show. And wherever you are in the world, I hope you're enjoying today's program. Perhaps you're one of the many people who download it from week to week as a podcast, available, of course, from our webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And it's always great fun to talk to people in other parts of the world. And I was able to appear on the Eric Metaxas show this last week, talking to him about the Big Conversation series that we started back in June, the special video debates on all kinds of big questions between leading voices in the Christian and atheist community. So if you want to check that out, it's on the Eric Metaxas show podcast. But it's been great to see the way that many people have been getting on board Unbelievable's newsletter, which we launched along with The Big Conversation. It's a fortnightly newsletter, and you'll get things like the highlights from recent shows, some great classic archive editions of the program, videos, resources, articles, and so on that I'm sharing through that particular newsletter. And on the last one that went out, I invited people at the top to send in their thoughts as well to the Unbelievable email address, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And it was fun to receive a lot of emails from people who have just got on board the show and with their recommendations for guests and topics they'd like to see appear. So I'll read some of those out a little later on in our feedback section at the end of today's programme. If you'd like to get yourself subscribed to the newsletter, then you can go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Simply follow the links there to the newsletter, or equally, The Big Conversation bigconversation.show. We'll get you subscribed. And the fifth episode of The Big Conversation in just a couple of weeks' time, which I'm really looking forward to, Daniel Dennett and Keith Ward on mind, consciousness and free will. That'll be a real philosophical, theological treat for all those interested in those particular issues. Just a couple of things to tell you before we get into the final part of today's discussion between James and Esther. Reboot is happening in London on Saturday the 22nd of September. That's this weekend. And I'm told that there are tickets available on the door. They've got over 1,000 young people going to that. It's going to be a great day for youth, teenagers, anyone with big questions that want to be answered. And it's not too late if you're a very large minute sort of person to just rock up on the door. Happening at the Emmanuel Centre in central London. Loads of great speakers, great topics. Rebootglobal.org if you want to find out more and get along there at short notice. Straight after Unbelievable today on The Profile, Sam Hales is sitting down with John Stevens, the National Director of the Fellowship of Independent Evangelical Churches. So listen out for that and indeed find it on its own podcast. That's The Profile. And next week here on the programme, well, we haven't got our usual programme. We're making way, as we do every so often during the year, for a fundraising appeal for Premier Christian Radio. In fact, Premier Christian Radio, as we approach the end of the financial year at the end of September, is facing about a £650,000 gap in its funding for its national transmission. So if you would like to help us to meet that gap before the end of September, then do feel free to go to the website premier.org.uk/donate, and you'll be able to do that. Premier and indeed Unbelievable, as part of what we offer, is very much a listener supported station, as are all of the various aspects of what we do beyond just the radio side. So next week, because we don't have an Unbelievable show, as we make space for that, I'm going to be putting out something special on the podcast for our podcast listeners, and you'll find out what that is next week. Time to get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, today on the programme, we've been talking about Jordan Peterson, the well-known Canadian psychology professor who's become something of an internet phenomenon and has filled stadiums now in some recent debates with atheist Sam Harris. We've been talking about the atheist movement, the intellectual dark web, the alt-right and other things as well. On a wide-ranging discussion today between Esther O'Reilly, my Christian guest, and James Croft, who's our atheist. We kind of got to the point where we were talking about the humanist sort of endeavour, and to some extent, another character who's, you know, been involved in this, one of the moderators in these debates, Douglas Murray, himself an atheist, yet concerned at what will happen if we reject a Judeo-Christian view of the sanctity of life. Do we have a solid enough foundation for our view of the intrinsic dignity, I suppose, of human beings and so on, to not lead us down some paths that I think both he and Peterson and others have argued have been trod before, when people have lost a kind of a transcendent perspective on human life. James, I mean, I went on your website of the Ethical Society of St. Louis before we came in the studio, and on the About page, it's all about the importance of humans, the flourishing of humans, the dignity of all humans, the equality, and so on. Very, very obviously, this is the most important. Humans are really important. And you're a humanist. And I think the
it's
big
right
question
there in the name,
that
isn't it,
exactly the big question that comes around so often with these debates is why what's so special about humans? Where does that get grounded in a world without, where ultimately it can all be boiled down to matter in motion?
Yes, that's often where people take the discussion. I had a rueful little smile when Esther mentioned Douglas Murray's article, Will Human Life Be Sacred in an Atheist World? Because I read that on her recommendation at the same time as news was breaking all across the US news, and I'm sure the world news, about the growing child abuse scandal in the Catholic Church and the hundreds and thousands of children who were raped, tortured, and sexually abused, with the sanction and support of all the mechanisms of that church, which did and continues to do everything it can to prevent the priests who perpetrated that injustice from being prosecuted. And I think that the existence of such church-sanctioned horror, it certainly doesn't undermine the value of all religion everywhere for all time, but it makes a mockery of the idea that God holds people back from doing terrible things. Clearly, as a simple psychological fact about humanity, that is false. People can do terrible things while occupying the highest positions in the hierarchy of a religious organization. And I'm certain that's true of secular organizations. I'm not saying that secular organizations are better. I'm merely saying that the claim that religious organizations and ways of thinking prevent people from doing bad things is obviously false and offensive, and doesn't take into account the capacity for evil which is in every human person, whether they're religious or not. And I believe powerfully that religious people can be motivated by their faith to do wonderful acts of moral courage. I moved to St. Louis 4 years ago. It was just before Mike Brown was murdered, and there was a huge surge of anti-racist activism, and many clergy in the area were involved in fighting for the dignity of people of color there, and I was involved alongside them in a small way, and I saw numerous acts of profound moral courage, people putting their bodies in between, you know, large lines of riot police and young black protesters, and being beaten and arrested and shot with wooden bullets and tear gassed for their beliefs. And when they tell me that that's because they're motivated by their faith tradition and the resources that they derive from that, I believe them. I believe them. I've sat in prayer circles with them, and I've taken streets with them, and spoken in political settings with them in order to bring about justice. I just think that it is perfectly possible to also derive resources for moral courage and human improvement from non-religious sources, and I think it's rather uncivil to suggest otherwise. Now, I think you might want to say that when you get down to the sort of brass tacks of the philosophical underpinnings, some people think that there might be a problem with deriving human value from a secular framework. I, as a philosopher, don't think that. I actually think the shoe is on the other foot, in the sense that I think it's very difficult to derive human value from a theistic framework, actually. But that I actually think the philosophical quibble over that question is less important than the psychological reality that I've seen with my own eyes, that people who are both secular and religious can draw from their traditions to be moral. And our tradition, the ethical humanist tradition that we celebrate at the Ethical Society of St. Louis, is built on one of the many ideas is built on is the motto Deed Before Creed. It's actually what we're exploring in our programs this month. And the idea is that ethical living is more important than whatever belief system brings you to ethical living. And so our members can have whatever beliefs they like about God and the afterlife and metaphysics, as long as they treat people, including non-human people, if there be such things, well. And that is honestly more important to me than the philosophical question. And I do recognize the philosophical question being posed. It's essentially, what reason do we have to be good, I think? Or how do you ground human value in a secular philosophy? And the founder of our movement, Felix Adler, was very concerned with that question himself. He was being raised to be a rabbi, to follow in his father's footsteps. He went to Germany to study religion and philosophy, and he found he couldn't believe in God anymore, and he suddenly worried, how can we ground human dignity in a godless framework? And he came up with a weird sort of neo-Kantian philosophy to do that I don't think is very convincing. It's one of the great things about our tradition, is that I can disagree with our founder and no one worries about that. But I think there are resources within secular moral philosophy to do a perfectly good job of explaining why human beings have moral value.
And Sam Harris believes he's done it in his book, The Moral Landscape.
Yeah, and I have quibbles with him.
Right,
you know?
So
you don't
go the Sam Harris
account.
Way. We probably don't have time to unpack your full
right.
account.
No. Sam Harris says some important things in that book about that topic. I think other philosophers also say important things. I mean, the basic argument that I would make if I was going to philosophically kind of lay out a position is that human beings have certain capacities for morally relevant experiences, and that is what gives them ethical value, is that we are able to suffer and hope and dream and experience pain and joy, and that we make those sorts of distinctions all the time in our ethical lives. We do not afford ethical value to the computer mouse in front of me or the pen that's on the table, because it doesn't have the capacity for those ethically relevant experiences. And I think that it is what makes people that give them value, i.e. they have inherent value, and that's enough, that it would be then the burden of someone who disbelieves that to say why they disbelieve it.
That's very helpful encapsulation of a much bigger topic, obviously. Now, I don't know where you want to go with that, Esther, because there's
I have several ideas of where to go, but I will try to be concise. All right.
Yeah, the next 4 minutes. How...
I'll give you 5 minutes as well. But do you want to unpack, I don't know if you've got any responses to what James initially started out with of, well, you know, it's evident that you don't, that knowing God is watching doesn't stop people from doing terrible things. Look at the Catholic child abuse scandal. And yes, the whole question of how we do ground our belief in intrinsic human value and dignity and so on.
Well, first of all, I noticed that he left out the second half of that quote from Murray. You know, he says, religion holds people back, though it does not always stop them. And I think that that's precisely what we've seen in the Catholic Church. I am quite angry, as James is as well, about the corruption that's been exposed. And I wrote a quite passionate little piece of my own about that.
May I just ask, are you saying that you think it would have been worse had it not been a religious institution, had it been a secular institution like a non-profit, for instance, and those sorts of accusations would have been levelled and then it would have been even worse? So that people were being held back, the abuse and the response to the abuse? Because I believe the opposite. I believe a secular institution accused of such crimes would be shut down now. I don't think it would be able to continue. I think the religious nature of the institution actually makes the abuse worse in this instance. So it's not God holding people back, but not completely. It's the religious nature of the institution making it worse.
Well, I think that what we're seeing, the factors we're seeing there, we see, you know, we see cronyism, we see favoritism.
And dogmatic belief in the rightness of the institution and the infallibility of the institution.
Yes, but in a very sort of worldly sense. I mean, I would say
I think it's in a very explicitly religious sense. I mean,
I wouldn't say that at all. I mean, I would say rather that the priests who are, you know, grooming young men and
women,
you know, picking out their favorite lovers
actually,
and whatnot, I would say that much like the Nazi guards, they also didn't believe that God was watching them. So...
What evidence do you have for that? They're priests, for goodness sake. I mean, what evidence do you have that they don't believe in God?
I mean, my goodness. I mean, read Richard Holloway. I mean, there are priests all over the place who will quite callously tell you that they say one thing and believe another. I mean,
so you're really saying that you think that this happened because all the abusers who did this and all the people who shielded them from justice, including the archbishops and the bishops and the, potentially by accusation the Pope himself, the current Pope, let alone the previous popes, all of them actually don't believe in God, and that's how they are able to do this.
Well, I can't speak for the Pope, but I would certainly say that, you know, let's just say that I don't see much of the fear of God in two priests who capture and torture a child.
I agree, but
James's side, is this the no true Scotsman fallacy here that you're employing?
I don't think
Esther?
So, because I there's no possible way that you can derive from the teachings of Christ and Christianity that it's permissible for an institution, for members of an institution, to cover each other's asses and to enable abuse and to strive for power and for worldly goals at the expense of truth and moral integrity. I mean, Christ is quite, it's Jesus who says that it were better that a millstone should be hung around the neck of such people. So, you know, clearly these are men who don't think there's a millstone waiting for them.
Maybe they do. Maybe they're repenting. I mean, the story suggests that these people were repenting of their own sins to other priests, and then that being kept confidential because of the nature of the confessional.
Repenting.
Were going to confession and talking about their own abuse of children.
What do we think repentance means? What do you think it means? It's like, oh yes, I'll go. And I mean, they were going to that explicitly because of the confidentiality. Because they knew, ha, if I say this in confession, then when they come and ask you questions, you won't be able to answer them because I told you in confidence. That was a quite calculated move there.
I think you can interpret it that way. I think it's very exculpatory of the institution. I think that requires quite a lot of special pleading on behalf of this institution. And again, I'm not making an argument that religious institutions are thereby worse than secular ones. I don't believe that, and I hope that's come across clearly. I'm just saying that the argument that secular ways of thinking necessarily will lead people overall to worse behavior seems to be belied by the fact that here we have a religious institution behaving in the worst possible way, defending that behavior, continuing today to fail to open up records and to pass people on to be prosecuted, to make anyone actually accountable for it. What secular institution can you think of could that happen in?
Well, I think it happens in politics. I think it happens in universities.
You think of if a political party was shown to have a paedophile ring exchanging photographs of children, naked children between them, there would be no legal consequences for any of the people in that party and they would continue to win elections and stuff like that? I just don't believe it. I think that's nonsense. If this happened in a company, their share price would plummet. I mean, they would go out of business. But the Catholic Church
Continues. I mean, there are a number of people who are leaving the Catholic Church as we speak. So you could say that in that sense, the Catholic Church's share prices are plummeting. But I want to come back. Can I come back
Of course. I didn't mean to make this a discussion of the topic.
Yeah. So I wanted to come back to the philosophical question a bit, because I think the important question is there a through line, and I see no through line from Christianity, from the teachings of Christ, to the behavior of corrupt individuals, because like James, I also believe that all men, both religious and non-religious, have the capacity for good and evil. On the other hand, I do think that when I read Richard Norman, for instance, I do think that I can draw a quite sharp through line from what he articulates, his understanding of human life and what gives human life value, to views that I think are quite abhorrent. So, for example, James was sort of echoing something that Norman says when he says that when we think about what gives human beings value, we think about our consciousness, we think about our desires, our actions, our interactions with people, in short, the things that we are able to do. He describes these as, quote, everything that underpins our moral understanding of respect for human life. This is page 125 of his book on humanism. And I would simply ask him, what do you do with a child who's paralyzed in a wheelchair, who can't speak, who can process only the most basic stimuli, perhaps, Do we say that therefore the child has less value because he's not able to partake in 80% of the things that we like to do as human beings? And I think I think that way lies as well the allowance of suicide, of assisted suicide, that I think my life is not worth living anymore because I don't want to be an empty shell rotting away in a nursing home somewhere. But that is consistent if you truly believe that that having these human experiences that we like is what gives life, human life, value. Then I'm afraid it's all too consistent to say, well, then yes, quite, that makes sense. You should be able to kill yourself. And I think this is to conflate two different meanings of the word value. I don't believe that our capacity to reason and to make art and to laugh and love and all those sorts of things are what confer value on the human person. I think rather that they evidence it. And I think that the moment you make those sorts of things the metric of value and of worth, then you logically go down a route that says, well, then in that case, abortion is fine, euthanasia is fine, assisted suicide, all these things. And I believe that that's a very, very dark
My sense is you probably are pro-choice, pro-euthanasia for those who want it, pro-assisted suicide to some extent, James.
Of course. Of course.
And in that sense, you're a humanist who obviously believes that there are conditions under which people should be able to end their life or choose to end the life of an unborn child and so on.
Yes, that's correct.
So I think Esther's problem is, it's because the fact that the value that you confer on people is to do with their ability to reason, have experiences, these morally sort of, these moral experiences that you talk of, but the problem is that then that does devalue certain humans.
So I think the way that I address, you're correct in describing my views on those matters. I think, firstly, I want to make a little philosophical distinction that for me seems quite important, but we can't unpack in the time that we have. That Esther said that Richard Norman, at least the humanist philosopher, wants to say that our capacity for certain sorts of experiences, desires and sufferings and joys and things like that, are what confer value on the human organism. And for her, she said, it's rather what evidences the value of the human organism. I think that's how you put it, Esther. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I'd use either of those terms. I would like to say it's what constitutes the value of the human organism, i.e. it is what is valuable in the human organism in an ethical sense. It's not that it grants the human organism value. It is what is valuable about it inherently. And that's why I say I believe in the inherent worth of people, including non-human people, animals that can have those sorts of experiences. And I think that there is no, I mean, it's a bit of a difficult thing to have a discussion about, because you were describing, for instance, the choice that someone might make to end their own life, and the way you were describing it, I heard as a perfectly reasonable thing someone might want to do. And I didn't hear any violation of any ethical principle in what you described, but clearly you do, because you were offering it as an example of something that I believe in that is wrong. I'll just say on this front, I recently lost my father. It's been 4 weeks yesterday. That my father died. I'm in London because he was very ill with cancer for a while, and then he got very suddenly ill. And I saw him the day before he died for the first time since January, so many months ago. And he looked like a skeleton. It was horrible. He looked appallingly ill. And it was very clear to me that he would die quite soon. It was not something I had been prepared for. And if he had continued in that condition, finding it very difficult to breathe, not eating, being essentially kept alive potentially by machines or by a drip, and he had asked me that he had said to me that he would prefer to die, I would absolutely have wanted him to be able to make that choice. And the reason why there's no inconsistency between that and valuing those things which constitute human dignity is that autonomy is one of the central components of human dignity. And it seems to me to traduce people's autonomy to tell them, you wish to die, but I will make you live, that is a cruel thing to do to someone. And there's no, I don't think there's any contradiction or actual problem there.
So can I just ask just one question? Do you believe that the person who is helpless, who is weak, who can, you know, barely speak or communicate or anything, who's been robbed of these things, do you truly believe that the person in that situation, whether because they're old or because they have a disability, that they have less dignity as a human person
than
you or I?
I think the way that I would describe that is if someone, for instance, if a human is brain dead and is incapable of experiences of any kind, and is being kept alive by external help, that I think that has ceased to be a person. That is an organism that is alive, that has ceased to have the qualities that make something a person. It's incapable of experience at that point, and therefore we do not have the same moral responsibilities towards that organism as we have towards people like you and Justin, just like we don't have the same responsibilities towards our pets, which we might love very much, than we do towards other human beings.
Well, what about a person who's not, you know, and we can quibble about brain dead, but what about Terri Schiavo, for example, the American woman who was dehydrated to death, who, you know, she still smiled when her mother walked into the room, but she couldn't do much else. Would we say, well, okay, perhaps she's still, say, 3/5 of a person, but maybe less of a person?
I think it depends what the purpose of the ethical calculation, as it were, if you want to put it in terms of a quantity, that you want to do. I think we should always be incredibly careful when we're talking about any process which might treat someone as any less of a person than anybody else.
And I certainly agree with that.
Yeah, I think that that's where we get into really dangerous ethical waters. And luckily, these sorts of questions tend to come up relatively rarely, and that's why they.
I mean, one of the issues that I know Douglas Murray raised, we will have to draw it to a close soon, was his worry was that the road we're heading down and have seen happen in some instances is, for instance, people who believe they're really depressed and they're not, they just don't think they're ever going to live a life that does not involve severe depression, being given the right to end their lives. I mean, do you think that that is a logical outworking of this kind of way of treating people should be able to simply end their lives if they just don't like their life.
I think your life is your own, and ultimately you have sovereignty over your own existence. And if you wish to cease to exist, that is a choice that only you have the right to make. And I mean that in a very technical sense, that no one has the right to force a person to continue to exist if they truly do not wish to continue to exist. And what I mean by that is, you know, we might imagine a situation where you're going to restrain someone perpetually, perhaps, in order to prevent them from killing themselves. I think that is more inhumane than allowing them to kill themselves.
I guess, to put it in very crude terms, though, does that mean you're not going to stop the person on the bridge about to jump into the water?
No, that doesn't mean that. And the reason why it doesn't mean that, although I might be wrong to make that decision, I would be perfectly open to the possibility that if I intervened to stop someone jumping off a bridge, right, then I could be doing violence to their rights, right? I totally open to that possibility. Mm-hmm. And it could be in the course of a conversation that I discover that they have thought long and hard about this process and talked to doctors and everything, and this is how they chose to end their life, and then I foiled it, and I'm a fool for doing so and a bad person for doing so. So I'm open to that possibility. But we do know from a lot of evidence about people who make suicide, try to kill themselves, it is that it is an impulsive act that many people do regret afterwards. And that is why in all the places where it is legal for someone to put in processes so that their life will end, it is a torturous and long process that involves counselling and professional input and all sorts of things to make it very difficult for people simply to say, well, I'm done.
But ultimately, they should have the right in the end to do that after due process is carried out.
Well, I would simply ask, who has the right to keep them living?
Esther, what's your response to that? Because I think that was kind of, as I say, where Douglas Murray's concerns lay. Where do you draw the line in a sense?
This is also Charles Krauthammer has also written quite...
That's a great name.
Yeah. Yes. Have you heard of him, perchance?
Probably only through your emails, Esther.
But carry on.
You should look up an essay. This is listener homework. Look up his essay, The Dutch Example. And there at the end, there's a quite potent paragraph where he says we are asked to become a society that when the desperate man on the bridge cries out to us, we are asked to be the society that pushes him over the edge when every decent human instinct within us would cause us to intervene and to pull him back. And I think, to bring this back around to Jordan Peterson, when I spoke with a young man who came to one of Peterson's events and asked him, you know, I plan on ending my life very soon. Why shouldn't I? And Peterson answered him at length. And finally, at the end, he said, don't be so sure that your life is yours to take. And Peterson here is not speaking as somebody who, you know, is in the grip of some Christian dogma or what have you. He's simply saying, don't be so sure that it is your right, because you are a locus of value, a locus of divine value, let's say, and to cut that off would be wrong. And I asked the young man afterwards, I said, you know, that's a quite controversial, sharp thing for Peterson to say. What was your response to that? Do you think that you needed to hear that, or would you have chosen not to commit suicide if he had been more, you know, non-judgmental, let's say? And he said, absolutely not. He said, I needed that. I needed those sharp words to go on living. And I know in my heart, I know that he's right. He's absolutely right. I don't have the right to throw this away.
And before we have to conclude, I think you even mentioned to this young man in question the big conversation episode between Peterson and Blackmore. Do you want to just explain what happened in that incident?
Yeah, I did. So in the conversation with Susan, you know, Susan talks about Cheerily. And by the way, I would just want to note that James has also said he hated that Susan said this, so I don't want to put myself at odds with James here. But Susan said that she would quite cheerfully inform her students, well, yes, of course, nothing matters. Yes, of course, you know, this doesn't mean anything. But so, you know, get on with it, girl. You know, you just sort of get up and go about your day. You're going to go to the loo. You're going to take breakfast. You're going to have tea, go to school and whatnot. And this is just what we do. It's just what this body does. And Jordan asks her, I think quite rightly, well, why get on with it, girl? You know, and she's a sort of naturally cheerful person who doesn't really understand what it would mean to not want to get on with it like this young man did. And I asked him, you know, suppose you were in her class and she'd given this little speech about just getting on with it. How would that have affected you? You know, how would you have responded? And he said, I would have been a goner. I would have been a goner for sure, because that's not me, you know, because I know he's quite depressed. Mm. And so it was Peterson who pulled him from the brink. And I think that, I think that's a lovely kind of note to end on, because I think that encapsulates the kind of effect that Peterson is actually having that I wish the media would talk about more, but you know, they will talk about what they will.
Well, we've talked about it at length here, at least. And James, I really appreciate you coming in and Esther being on the line to have this fascinating back and forth. And wish we had more time as ever, but maybe we can do it again at some point in the future. All the best as you travel back to the US and take up your chaplaincy role again.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to being home after a while.
And Esther, we look forward to more from you and your blog on Pathios. I'll make sure there are links to what you're writing at the moment as well. Thanks for being on the show, Esther.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts on Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, the intellectual dark web, the alt-right, the atheist movement and Christianity. Send them in to unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And the social media is facebook.com/unbelievablejb or @unbelievablejb for the Twitter account as well. And you can equally leave a comment underneath today's edition of the programme at the webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Someone who emailed in, Doug, I thought I'd read this out first because it's relating to Jordan Peterson, says, I'm a new listener in Sydney, Australia. Discovered your show after Jordan Peterson posted his debate with Susan Blackmore on his own podcast channel. I've since been working through the whole catalogue of Unbelievable, finding it tremendously stimulating and helpful for my faith. I'm a Christian who's been fascinated by Jordan's approach to interpreting Bible stories. I had little background knowledge of him when I read his book, 12 Rules for Life, earlier this year. By halfway through, I found myself asking the question whether he might have a Christian faith. My subsequent exploration of his other work revealed that he's very difficult to pin down on the question of who the historical Jesus really was and whether the resurrection was a historical fact. I thought you and Susan got tantalizingly close to getting his thinking on the real person of Jesus right at the end of your program. He quoted Jesus and commented that his words on the separation of church and state were miraculous. Then you were out of time. I'm just wondering whether you got another opportunity with Jordan privately to press him on that subject. If so, I'd love to hear what you found out. Please have him back on the show to get him talking about Jesus. Well, I would love to get Jordan Peterson back on the show. So who knows? Perhaps we can do that, Doug. But what you heard was essentially the time I had with Jordan Peterson. Obviously, on the occasion he was with me, he was on a busy press schedule and we got the time we got, and that was it, really. It's been interesting, though. I think there's lots of places you can look to find more on his particular thoughts on Jesus, God, and so on. I think his thinking is evolving on that, I would say. I'd be interested to see where it does land up. Great to have you get in touch, Doug. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of people got in touch after I, on the new Unbelievable newsletter, put out the email address that people can contact the show through, and a number of people who are new subscribers to the newsletter did that with some short messages like this from David, who says, thanks for the many interesting show topics. Will you be having Keith Ward on again? I rate his show appearances very highly. Well, as I might have mentioned earlier, David, yes, Keith Ward and Daniel Dennett, the well-known atheist philosopher will be sitting down together on the next episode of The Big Conversation in about 2 weeks' time, so look out for that. Jeffrey says, love the show. Writing to suggest that you feature Trent Horn versus Richard Carrier on abortion, or Trent Horn versus Daniel Dombrowski on abortion, or both. Trent Horn versus Richard Carrier on the historicity of the Gospels and Acts would also be interesting. Thank you very much. Another person, Craig, says, how about Matt Dillahunty and John Lennox, or maybe William Lane Craig? Yeah, all good suggestions, all people who have been on in some form or another over the years, not necessarily in those combinations. Here's another one from Kevin, who says, love the show. Not sure if you've heard of the Hebrew Roots movement, not the Black Hebrew Israelite movement, that's something different. There's precious little good debate out there on the Hebrew Roots movement, and it would be really helpful to have it discussed on a show like yours. If you're interested at all in this and want more info, let me know. Thank you, Kevin. I did take a quick look into that. It looks to me, just in my cursory examinations, like a sort of slightly more extreme version of Messianic Judaism, possibly. But yeah, I will bear that in mind. And Corbus says, thank you very much for showing me how to be able to differ from non-believers in a civil and mature way. After listening to the latest podcast, I have a question that might be a good debate topic. If science is the way, I don't think we have any reason to fear anything in artificial intelligence. What would be able to do better science than an artificial intelligence? And if moral law is inherent, then that should be able to evolve very quickly in AI. So why fear that AI will destroy humans if it's only objective and would be just about doing science? If science gives us enough to base our moral choices on, then there should be no need or fear of AI ever missing its mark. And you say, it might sound confusing, but it's a big topic, but I've been thinking about it a lot. I think that's an interesting question, actually, Corbus. Would AI, if it were to develop, be moral? Would it suddenly reach the same moral conclusions that we have developed ourselves as humans, if it really is just a case of rationality and science that ultimately determine what's moral? Thank you very much. We had some emails as well in response to the show between Sean McDowell and Hemant Mehta, that live discussion that I moderated in Portland, Oregon for Unbelievable Conference USA. Was able to put that out on video and podcast last week. Jim just has one question for Sean McDowell. Is genocide objectively wrong? Can we all agree on it? Well, without Sean here to answer, perhaps I can guess what he would say. I think he would say genocide is objectively wrong. But you've probably got a follow-up question to that. Whether we all agree on it, well, obviously, those who practice it don't agree on it. But that doesn't mean it's not objectively wrong, because you don't have to have universal agreement for something to be recognised as objectively true. John wants to talk about the father rejection argument that came up in the discussion between Sean and Hemant. He says, I'm a Christian, but struggle quite a bit with lots of Christian apologetics. There's honestly a lot of confirmation bias going on out there. I'm still hoping in a gracious God on that one. Anyway, I just wanted to share that I totally get Hemant's scepticism on the father rejection point that Sean tried to introduce. My grandfather abandoned his family when my dad was 13. Although never abandoned myself, I have experienced definite trauma, huge disappointment, etc., with my dad's insecure parenting and emotional absence or immaturity. I have frequently doubted, but I hold on to faith because that's my extended family and community. And through it, I hope for and experience the dad I didn't have. Hope that makes sense. Please let me know. That's an interesting one, perhaps kind of pointing in the opposite direction, that maybe for those who don't have a father, that Christianity is something that they embrace because of that. Thank you very much. And finally, here's Corey, who wanted to get in touch after that show. He was actually at the debate and says, thanks again for holding the conference in Portland. It was delightful to finally meet you in person at the book table. Regarding Hemant's remarks, how are we to take seriously his claim to trust evidence when he denies that 10 eyewitnesses of a crime are an insufficient basis for a conviction, or asserts that there's no evidence for God's existence? If I'm ever accused of a crime in Chicago, I hope he's on my jury. In reality, it would never happen, because any reasonable prosecuting attorney would reject him during jury selection, because his standard is insufficient for any conviction. I don't believe his assertion for a moment. he would surely convict on far less evidence, as long as the offence in question isn't the crime of being God. I think he's probably a reasonable person in other matters. Hemant's atheism is not based on a lack of evidence, but rather a lack of proof. And during the discussion with Sean McDowell, he slipped a couple of times and used the two terms interchangeably. I think it would do well for him to consider the distinction and reflect on all the things he believes based on convincing evidence that don't rise to the level of the unreasonable standard of proof. Some evidence demands a verdict, even if it isn't proof. Thanks again. Hope to see you in the USA again. Corey, I hope to be out there at some point, not too long too. In fact, we have a date that's materialising and I think is going to be confirmed pretty soon in late March, when I'll be out in Seattle to moderate another interesting dialogue, a live dialogue, and be involved in a conference. It's not the Unbelievable conference this time, but I will be out there to be involved with that. So I'll give you more details as they're made available. Watch this space. Late March in Seattle, if you're on the West Coast, might be a good opportunity to connect again. And before we have to wind up today's show, we've also had a lot of stuff that I haven't been able to get to, but really interesting responses to the Islam debate between Ed Hussein and Beth Grove. They were debating the history of Islam. And here's a couple of the responses we had on this. Aristotle's Jedi says, "I tried not to get worked up listening to the podcast, but I failed repeatedly. Ed's poor grasp of Christian history wasn't my cup of tea. He threw out the tired but quite strongly rejected thesis that Christianity caused the cracks which brought the Roman Empire to its knees. It's as strongly rejected as the idea that Christian Europe was anti-science. One problem is that all major Christian factors for the downfall of the Western Roman Empire were in play in the East, yet that part of the empire lasted centuries more. He also thought Augustine was against Greek philosophy and reason." I'm sorry, but Augustine was thoroughly Neoplatonic. "It was this philosophy which laid the foundations of his conversion. It's best don't bore you with his mistaken views on Aquinas and his role in history. Let me finish with this, a good note. I think every non-Muslim can and should support this sort of movement by Ed and others for the sake of a peaceful world." Christian in Sweden said, "I've been listening to Unbelievable for years now, really enjoy the podcast, but last week's episode with Ed Hussein and Beth Grove struck a negative chord with me. It seemed to me that Beth landed some jabs that were unnecessary, unrelated to the conversation, and hurtful towards Ed's picture of Christianity and maybe others. It was a reminder to me of the winsomeness of generosity and genuine questions. I'd love to hear more from Ed on the role of the Quran in Islam and what rationale he would give to a Muslim textualist. I'm also very curious why he continued as a Muslim instead of becoming an agnostic or humanist. I applaud his vulnerability in showing some of his struggle with Islam. I'll be checking out his book." And finally on this one, Derek in Abbotsford, Canada says, "Listening to this episode, I couldn't help but wonder if Ed Hussein was coached by Peter Atkins before he came on the show. My word, he hardly engaged with any of what Beth was talking about and was just as zealous lecturing and mine is the only way as he claimed Beth to be. Somehow, his is legitimate, though I can't understand why. His self-awareness of how he portrays himself seemed far off. It wasn't very professional of him to just say, well, that's just baloney, in a dismissive way without any backup as to why. I felt he was outgunned and tried to make himself not look weak and use some poor tactics to do it. He didn't sound like someone who's confident in what he was saying and felt he had to shout down and insult any opposing voices. Well done, Beth, for keeping your composure." So some different interpretations of what happened on that show between Beth Grove and Ed Hussein. It's all available, of course, at the podcast archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, where you can sign up for the Unbelievable newsletter, download the app, find the YouTube channel, the Big Conversation series, this year's UK conference on DVD, MP3 CD and digital download, and much more besides. It's your one-stop shop for all things Unbelievable. Look forward to seeing you next time.
You're unbelievable.
For those who are listening via radio, that will be in a couple of weeks' time, because next weekend we're giving over the usual programming for the sake of our end of financial year appeal, as we attempt to meet the £650,000 funding gap that currently exists for Premier. If you're able to help us with that, then do make sure to give to this week's campaign, premier.org.uk/donate. In fact, it's a team effort. I'll be on the Inspirational Breakfast Show alongside John Pantry between Tuesday to Friday as we host that fundraising appeal. But we will be putting out a podcast special, as we often do when we don't have the usual radio show in place. So look out for that on your podcast feed. You'll be getting something special this time next week. But for the moment, thanks for being with me here on the Unbelievable Radio Show and Podcast. I'll sign off until next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.